Here is a point Rousseau would reiterate. Personal misery is not the result of God or nature or of original sin. It is the result of the evil institutions of a corrupt society. Very soon, Rousseau would begin to expound this heartfelt feeling in works that have left their mark to the present day. In the summer of 1749, Rousseau underwent an experience which changed his life, as well as the course of modern political thought. His friend Diderot had published a work which was considered anti-religious. Accordingly, an order for his arrest was issued by the director of publications of the French government. Diderot was thrown into prison a few miles east of Paris. One day, Rousseau, who could not afford a carriage ride, walked to visit his friend. In a copy of a newspaper he took with him, he saw the announcement of an essay contest proposed by the Academy of Dijon. The topic, has the progress of the arts and sciences done more to corrupt or to purify morals? Upon reading this, Rousseau had a revelation which has been compared to the one St. Paul experienced on the road to Damascus.
All at once I felt my mind dazzled by a thousand lights. A crowd of splendid ideas presented themselves to me with such force, in such confusion, that I was thrown into a state of indescribable bewilderment. Unable to breathe and walk at the same time, I sank down under one of the trees in the avenue and passed the next half hour in such a state of agitation that when I got up, I found that the front of my jacket was wet with tears, although I had no memory of shedding any. If ever I had been able to write down which I saw and felt as I sat under that tree, with what clarity would I have exposed the contradictions of our social system, with what simplicity would I have demonstrated that man is naturally good and has only become bad because of those institutions.
After conferring with Diderot, Rousseau decided to submit an essay. This first major work, known as the Discourse on the Arts and Sciences, or the First Discourse, argued that progress in civilization had led to the decline of morals. Rousseau was 37 years old, his life more or less at loose ends. This essay made him famous. The First Discourse made a kind of revolution in Paris, largely because it ran directly against the grain of progressive thinking among the philosophes. At the same time that Rousseau's essay appeared, the prospectus was being published for the Encyclopedia, the grand work edited by Diderot and the mathematician and philosopher Jean d'Alembert, which would set forth the knowledge of the age. Extending to some 28 volumes and appearing over 2 decades, this work was so important that the whole school of philosophes is sometimes referred to as the Encyclopedists. Besides Rousseau himself, Voltaire, Turgot, Quinet, and many other advanced writers contributed. The Encyclopedia was shaped and animated by a doctrine derived from the English philosopher Francis Bacon. Through reason, manifested in the sciences and the practical and fine arts, man could improve his lot and progress toward a higher and better form of social life. Now, in First Discourse, Rousseau challenged that faith in uncompromising terms. Every science, Rousseau maintained, was rooted in some vice. The arts were hopelessly tied up with luxury and fine living and generated corruption both in the individual and in the state. On this, Rousseau was open to criticism. He was a novice philosopher who asserted the corrupting influence of philosophy, a writer of books who despised book writing, a composer and musical theorist who declared the arts to be morally injurious. But it can be argued that, as always with Rousseau, you must go beyond the surface paradoxes and exaggerated rhetoric. Rousseau's point of view might win more adherents today if it was restated as follows. Moral goodness is infinitely more important and admirable than any intellectual or artistic accomplishment. Only a corrupt people can be blind to this fact. Moreover, cultural achievements cover up moral degradation.
Nowadays, when the most elaborate education and the most cultivated taste have reduced the art of pleasing to a set of rules, every precept of politeness demands constant obedience. Good manners are dictated to us. We must always follow commands, never our own nature. Under this endless constraint, we no longer dare to appear as we are. In that flock of sheep we call society, each man in the same situation does exactly the same as others.
This complaint came from the heart, and it found a response in the hearts of many readers. It has become part of the evidence that Rousseau was individualistic, a man who railed against social conventions which constricted individuality and suffocated spontaneity. It should be noted, however, that the social conventions Rousseau objects to are those produced by a corrupt society. Rousseau is still free to claim that in a virtuous society, the individual finds his true freedom affirmed by his perfect agreement with the customs of that society. In later years, Rousseau came to think poorly of the first discourse. Publicized by influential friends, however, it was an overnight sensation. For the most part, oddly enough, it did not sour Rousseau's relations with the encyclopedists. He continued to be friendly with Diderot and to contribute to the encyclopedia. But some wondered whether they were harboring an individual who was not quite the perfect philosophe he had seemed. Their suspicions grew and were aggravated by Rousseau's next major work. In 1754, the Academy of Dijon proposed another essay question. What is the origin of inequality among men, and whether it is authorized by natural laws? Rousseau's Discourse on the Origin and Foundations of Inequality Among Men, known as the Second Discourse, became even more celebrated and influential than the first. Both Edmund Burke and Napoleon looked on it as the fountainhead of the French Revolution. Published in 1755, the Second Discourse is a scathing attack on the institutions of organized society and on the type of human being they produce. Rousseau begins with man in the state of nature. This is a familiar concept, utilized by many preceding political philosophers. Rousseau's state of nature, however, differs in crucial respects. With the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes, the state of nature implies a war of all against all, waged by human beings who are innately aggressive and competitive. With another English philosopher, John Locke, a law of nature guides and rules over the state of nature, a law which individuals by and large obey even without government. Rousseau will have none of this. Both conceptions, he maintains, illegitimately import attitudes and desires into man's earliest state that could only have developed over long ages in close association with other men. The philosophers who have examined the foundations of society, Rousseau says, have felt the necessity to return to the state of nature, but none of them ever reached it. The true beginning of man, Rousseau maintains, was before language, before the family, virtually before thought itself. It is a condition of total isolation, hence total freedom.
Having neither houses or huts, nor possessing property of any sort, everyone depended on chance for his lodging, and often slept only one night in any one place. Males and females united fortuitously, according to encounters, opportunities, and desires. They required no speech to interpret the things they had to say to each other, and they separated with the same ease.
Man was content to live as the beasts did. He possessed only two natural capacities, the ability to feel pity and the ability for development. From the ability to feel pity comes man's moral feelings and his compassion. From the ability for development comes all the things, for good or evil, which distinguish civilized man from primitive or natural man. Man leaves this original state of nature and gradually comes to live in what Rousseau calls nascent society. Here he has a settled abode, a family life, and the simple beginnings of property. He associates with his fellows, but these are generally bonds of friendship and mutual aid. All in all, Rousseau believes this is man's happiest state. Tragically, it does not last.
He who sang or danced the best, he who was the most handsome, the strongest, the most adroit, or the most eloquent, became the most esteemed. And that development marked the first step toward inequality, and at the same time towards vice. From these first preferences were born, on the one hand, vanity and contempt, and on the other, shame and envy. The fermentation caused by these new leavens finally yielded compounds ruinous both to happiness and innocence.